from Santa Barbara, California. The Timeless Voyager with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Talk radio for the new age. Interviews with well-established professionals in the fields of New Age philosophy, holistic health care, energy healing, psychic phenomena, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, Timeless Voyager Radio. And with me today on the show, Dr. Deepak Chopra. The book that I'm very important, the one that is out now, Unconditional Life. The other book's Creating Health, Return of the Rishi, Quantum Healing, and Perfect Health. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be on your show again.
Now, you, the most recent book, Unconditional Life, Mastering the Forces that Shape Personal Reality, this moves quite a bit now from just the physical body into the realm of consciousness.
Right, it does. It gives us the insight, I hope, that our physical bodies also are nothing other than fields of consciousness, fields of awareness, that our essential nature is that we are made out of a pure awareness, as is the rest of the universe. And a spiritual experience, basically, is one in which pure awareness reveals itself as the maker of reality. And when we have that, then our life becomes unconditional. It's not imprisoned through the bars of past conditioning. We are suddenly free from the known. It's not the unknown that we should fear. It's the known, because the known is the rigid patterns of past conditioning. Once we get out of those rigid patterns of past conditioning, then we have real, true psychological freedom, and then even our wishes, dreams, and desires come true at the touch of an intention.
So you're saying, I think what you're saying, if I'm listening correctly here, is that what we've learned about our physiology through the, and use this term a lot, the mistake of the intellect, is what has caused us to become what we are today, namely mortal instead of immortal.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, who are we really? Are we a physical body which has produced some kind of epiphenomenon called consciousness, or are we the animating force of life itself? And the animating force of life itself is a field of infinite organizing power. It's a field of pure potentiality, which engenders through its own self-interaction space, time, matter, and energy. Human awareness is capable of awakening itself to this, to the informational content of this life force. We can tap into the cosmic computer using the brain as our keyboard. And once we do this, then, you know, our whole perspective of who we are really changes, because then we realize that we are not this physical body. We are the animating force of life itself that creates this body.
Now, in your particular case, were not always talking like this. You actually changed quite a bit when you became aware of Ayurvedic medicine, or Ayurveda, is that correct?
Yeah.
And maybe you could just give everyone a background for a moment. You are an MD, and somehow your life changed through your meeting with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Yeah, I'm an MD, if that's an important credential. I guess it is to some people. I'm an endocrinologist and also an internist. That's the label I go by, because I happen to have studied those and practiced those. But in about 1980, I came across Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. I was quite unhappy with the kind of medicine I was practicing at that time, seeing patients all day and dispensing prescriptions for tranquilizers and sleeping pills and antibiotics. I would tell my patients, listen, you ought to stop smoking and not drink so much and lose some weight, and maybe we can get you off some of these drugs. And they'd say, listen, my mother-in-law says the same thing. She doesn't charge me $50. How do I do it? Tell me what to do. And, you know, modern medicine and the practice of it is such that although we know all the right things to tell our patients, we're not equipped with the right tools. and we do not have at our disposal the technologies to make people do the things that they should be doing, and not only make them do those things, but to enjoy doing those things, to begin to experience their own bliss, to begin to experience their own awareness, to begin to get control over their life, to begin to understand that they are the creators of their mind, their body, and their universe.
So essentially what you're saying is that as an MD, the problem was not necessarily that you couldn't tell a person what the problem was that they were having a very difficult time following the directions.
Right, exactly, because we're not trained to help them make the right decisions for their life. And even if they know what the right decisions are, they are so victimized by their own conditioning that it's very difficult for them to get free.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Ayurvedic medicine. I know that it's quite a large subject, but maybe just for our listeners, you could give a quick, maybe a history and an idea of what it is actually about.
Ayurveda goes back 6,000 years, and its basic tenet is that we are part of nature, that we are a recycled earth, water, and air, like everything else that exists on our planet, that we are part of a larger cosmic body. And this cosmic body, which we call the universe, is not just inert lumps of matter, but alive, throbbing, pulsating, organic life itself. That this whole universe is composed of energy and information fields that are self-referral and influence their own expression. That the human body, therefore, is a part of the cosmic body. There's an expression in Ayurveda, which goes somewhat like this: as is the atom, so is the universe; as is the microcosm, so is the macrocosm; as is the human body, so is the cosmic body; as is the human mind, so is the cosmic mind. And once our the information and energy fields in our body align themselves with the energy and information fields in the universe, then we feel perfect harmony and balance, and that's the definition of health. It's not merely the absence of a disease or an infirmity, but an aliveness, an energy, a feeling of happiness and bliss and life throbbing through us. We feel animated and we feel joyful, and we feel that there is a purpose to living, we are here to enjoy ourselves and have fun.
Now, you've discussed many times, and certainly as I've listened to another one of your, I should say the word product, because it's a product in the sense, the Magical Mind, Magical Body series, you basically are saying that everything that happens to our physiology has to do with our consciousness and our thought. Is that correct?
That's correct. But let's not, you know, people get stuck in the realm of thought. It is true that thoughts become molecules, and it is true that the mind projects itself as the body. But what are these thoughts, and what is the mind? And I would say that a thought is an impulse of energy and information. And even though that impulse of energy and information ultimately manifests itself as a space-time event, which is a molecule, it's not the mind that we need to control, because you can't do it. I mean, there's no way you can control the mind and manipulate it. If you have negative thoughts, you have negative thoughts. The harder you try to push them out, the more dominant they become in your awareness. What you need to do is to get in touch with something which is beyond body and mind. And we can use the word consciousness, or we can say it's that animating force that expresses itself as both body and mind. It's the spirit. It's the field of pure potentiality that creates everything through its own self-interaction. Einstein once defined the field as a continuum of probability distributions for possible measurements as functions of time. In other words, a field is dimensionless, spaceless, timeless. It is just a continuum of pure potentiality. that engenders through its own self-interaction those impulses of information and energy that will subsequently manifest as space-time events that we call matter. We are that field. We are the field of pure potentiality. We are the spirit, the life-animating spirit that manifests everywhere. We must get in touch with that aspect of ourselves that is absolutely universal, because the awareness that flows through me projecting my world is the same awareness flowing through you and creating another world for you. But ultimately it's the same field of intelligence that is expressing itself as different modes of perception. If I can get in touch with that core of my inner being, then I can change my life. Not only can I change my life, I can change the world that I live in.
Now, there's certainly an idea from the most recent book. I guess it's called Freeing the Mind and the True Self. Is this what we're talking about?
Yes. And what is this true self? You know, it's, most of us have relinquished ourselves, forsaken ourselves for our self-image. The self-image is the social veneer, the protective mask, the image behind which we hide. And most people spend their entire lifetime trying to maintain the integrity of this self-image. In the process, they lose touch of their self. And the self-image is very calculating. It calculates, it's intellectual, it chooses its behaviors in anticipation of other people's responses, because its main function is to maintain its own integrity. And if one's life is governed by one's self-image, which it is most of the time, then that awareness that permeates that being, that entity, that human being, is a fear-permeated awareness. You're constantly living in fear because you've got to protect the self-image. On the other hand, if it is yourself that is choosing life's behaviors, then the awareness that permeates that experience is one of aliveness, one of joy, one of present moment awareness. Here, present moment awareness is such that the right response comes to you for every event as and when it arises. We call it spontaneous right action, where the right and perfect response to every situation as it occurs is built in every moment in our awareness. The response is intuitive, it is natural, and it is outside the bounds of rationality. There are rapid shifts of energies and opportunities inherent in every moment of our life. And there's a fine level of feeling which provides the necessary mechanisms for the most precise and correct response to the changes that are inherent in every moment. When we have present moment life-centered awareness, we feel alive. When we have fear and anxiety permeated awareness, that's the beginning of suffocation, imprisonment, and death.
So you're just basically saying that what happens in this, what we might refer to as an unseen area, is basically what causes us to live or even die at this point.
Yeah, it is true. You know, there's a saying from Adi Shankara, one of the reasons why people grow old and age and die is they see other people growing old, aging and dying. What we see, we become. We metabolize, interpret our experiences, and then we convert them into the molecules of our body. If you want to seek that realm of immortality, then we have to shift from what is called object referral to self referral. It's a perceptual shift. It means that suddenly our identity is experienced in terms of its universality. There is a conscious and spontaneous awareness that the source of my individuality is the same as that of all individuality. I am that source. It allows my attention or my awareness to shift from the objects of my perception to the flow of awareness itself. And then present moment life-giving awareness begins to dominate and flow freely through my mind and body. It begins to dominate my perceptual experiences. the light of pure consciousness shines through every object of my perception, my identity shifts from the contents of my consciousness to consciousness itself. And it is this consciousness that conceives, governs, and becomes everything. When I get in touch with the contents of my own consciousness and become their silent witness, then I get in touch with all of reality, because all of reality is nothing but the contents of my own consciousness. I actually don't live in the world, it lives in me. And once you realize that the world that you live in is your projection, you are free of it. You need not free yourself of a world that does not exist except in your own imagination. So it is a great feeling of power that comes, and it's real power. It's not the kind of fearful power that people who have anxiety permeated awareness have. That kind of power is a desperate need for power that fearful people cannot help. It's a power which is a form of self-protection. But when the fear is gone, then there is no need for that kind of protection. Then you acquire the power of love, which doesn't allow even the birth of an enemy.
Let's talk for a moment on this concept, and I think in the book you refer to this as the mistake of the intellect.
Yes. The mistake of the intellect is that the intellect begins to identify with the objects of its perception rather with the source of its own creation. The intellect is a form of rational thinking, or what we call logic. But what is this rational thinking? It's nothing other than a justification of our reality map. Our reality map comes from a sensory interpretation of the universe. We say what the eye see is the way things are, that seeing is believing, which is of course such a superstition, because you know the senses tell us that the earth is flat and nobody believes that anymore. The senses tell us that the ground we're standing on is stationary and we know it's hurtling through outer space at thousands of miles an hour. The senses tell us there's a certain texture, shape and look to the world, and the fact is that's only our way of looking at it. In reality, the senses are really the least reliable test or crucial test of reality. And nevertheless, our whole system of logic and so-called rationality or intellect is based on this sensory interpretation of the world. So so-called rationality is really an imprisoning form of thinking. It is toxic, it is confining, and it is imprisoning. It is identifying with the objects of our perception, in fact, when we are not those objects. If you meet somebody on the street and you ask them, who are you? Basically, they tell you all the things that they identify with. You know, their job, their name, their nationality, their social security number, their relationships, the car they drive, and things like that. That's not who they are. Those are the objects of their perception. And that's the mistake of the intellect. Correcting the mistake of the intellect is to go beyond the clutches of this so-called rationality and going to that finest level of feeling, which is literally the universe's way of giving us the right signal. Because built into our awareness is this very fine level of feeling and emotion, what we call, you know, operating from the heart. And this is our own intuition. And the intuition is basically the cosmic mind, the cosmic computer, whispering to us silently in the gap between our thoughts. It's not in the thought, but it's in the gap between our thoughts. When we slip into this gap between our thoughts, then we find ourselves, and there's a light and there's a love here. And if we stay in this, and we be in this, and we be in this love, then we can solve not only our own problems, but even the world's problems seem to start getting solved.
Now, when you refer to this gap, it has been said, for instance, that the brain's main function is to fill in all of the holes in the script, so to speak. Inside or somewhere lying below this gap is and you've had these two terms, I guess you've named them as I-ness and am-ness. Maybe you could discuss those for a moment.
Yeah. See, what is this gap? This gap is who we really are. This. You know, there's an interesting experiment that Dr. Wilder Penfield did a few years ago. several years ago. He was a neurosurgeon who got the Nobel Prize in Medicine. He was from Canada. One of his classic experiments was he had a patient open for neurosurgery. He was operating on the patient. He was trying to see which part of the brain controlled which part of the body. And he was stimulating a part of the motor cortex with a little electrical probe. And at one point, when he was stimulating it, the patient's arm started moving up. And he said, what's happening? And the patient said, my arm is moving up. And he said, are you moving the arm? And the patient said, no, it's moving up. So he said, well, then why don't you move it in the other direction? And the patient did. Now, no matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you look, and it doesn't matter what kind of instrumentation you have and what kind of sophisticated gadgetry you have, you'll never find the location of that one who issues the command to move the arm here or there. You'll find the location in the brain of that place which executes the command, but you'll never find the name of the place that decides or chooses to give that command. You'll never find the commander, because the commander is not in the realm of space-time, and it's not local. It's nowhere and everywhere at the same time. It's in the gap between your thoughts. The gap between your thoughts is the corridor, the window, the transformational vortex through which the individual self communicates with the cosmic self. In each gap between my thoughts, there is a field of infinite possibilities. As I speak to you, I could say, listen, Bruce, I'm going to take off my shoes. Or I could say, Bruce, I'm going to hang up on you. Or I could say, Bruce, I'm going to take a flight to Paris. Between the going to and the next word is a little gap of silence which contains infinite possibilities. And yet each gap between each thought is qualitatively different from the preceding and following gap, because it engenders a slightly different probability amplitude by virtue of the intention contained in the gap. So my little self, even though it is a gap of our field of all possibilities, it has taken certain modes of transformation that give the I-ness to me. The am-ness is in that field of universal cosmic mind. So if I slip a little bit beyond those probability amplitudes into the deeper realms of the silent gap, then I am that non-local field of information and intelligence that permeates the entire cosmos. And then my little Atman, my little self, has suddenly merged with the cosmic self, and can then identify myself with my universality. The trick is, of course, if I can maintain that experience of universality along with my individuality, then I have integrated infinite silence with infinite dynamism, and that's then I'm a cosmic being while at the same time maintaining my individuality. And that's the ultimate goal of Vedic knowledge.
Let's take this a little bit pragmatically now. The reason this all happened was because I think the questions that came up in the beginning were, why do people age? Why do they become diseased? And it seems like this begins to hold some of the answers to that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, because, I am where my attention takes me. I am nothing other than my attention. And my attention is in the field of relativity. It is in the field of change. It's in the field of mortality. Then I will be all those things, because I am nothing other but than the expression of the quality of my attention. On the other hand, if I awaken to the presence of my spirit and I am in present moment awareness, then I have awakened to my eternal being. I have awakened to my universality. I have awakened to my absolute nature, which is beyond change, even though it is the source of all change. To be caught in the spell of mortality is to have your attention in the field of change. To break through the mask of mortality and experience the field of immortality is to penetrate the field of change, to go through the subtle body, which is a holographic information and energy template, and ultimately to end up with the screen itself, which is the source of even that subtle body, and that is nothing other than my true self, my immortal spirit that has no beginning in time, no ending in time, no edges in space. It's timeless, dimensionless, pure being, and that's who I am. And when I get in touch with that, then I've gotten in touch with my immortality. The Veda speaks of it as the causal body, which is beyond change, which fire cannot burn, which water cannot wet, wind cannot dry, weapons cannot cleave. It's timeless, it's without beginning in time, without ending in time, and it's ancient, and it's unborn, and it never dies.
Now this evidently, according to what I understand then, is let's say why people who are practicing some constant repetition of this experience, this transcendental type experience, seem to have a change in their biological and chronological ages.
Yeah, it's well known, for example, that people who have been practicing TM or transcendental meditation for more than 5 years, their biological age is 12 years younger than their chronological age. But more important than that, Bruce, even more important, I mean, that's fascinating, that's wonderful, and that's great, and it shows that aging is not a given one-way street, that you can even reverse the biological parameters of aging. But much more important than that to me is the psychological shift that takes place in the direction of freedom. You lose the fear of mortality because you've gotten in touch with your immortal spirit. And then once you've lost that fear, you know, fear itself is one of those things that hastens the aging process. Once that fear is lost, even aging is not a very significant concern of yours. Of course, paradoxically, when it's no longer a concern of yours, you begin to have an exquisite control over it.
And what about the concept of disease?
Disease in the beginning begins just as a change in awareness. That's why we call it dis-ease. And dis-ease is a sign that we have deviated from the self-referred path of our own bliss. And in fact, disease is in nature's way of bringing us to the right path. And it's part of the evolutionary process. Disease is a metaphor for our mistake of the intellect. And if we are conscious of the messages of discomfort that come to us as our own awareness, then we use that as an opportunity to wake up, to go to that field of pure wakefulness, where we will once again have the presence of our eternal spirit in every second of our existence. To be fully awake is to have that crystal clarity awareness at all times. And in that crystal clarity awareness, when your being is free, then you carry the consciousness of eternity at all times. And then you are free and you get healed spontaneously.
What is your concept of time?
Time is nothing other than a concept. It's a concept that we have we use to explain our experience of sensory change. If you're having a good time, then time flies. If you're having a bad time, then time drags. If you're having a peak unity experience, then time comes to a standstill. So time is the way we measure our subjective experiences. There was a case report recently from Germany of 7 miners who had been trapped in a mine, and they had limited quote-unquote time, and only one of the miners had a watch, and he wanted to allay the anxieties of the other people. So every time 2 hours went by, he would call out 1 hour. At the end of the week, they were rescued and they were all alive except for the one who was calling out the time. In other words, this person happened to manage to change the collective agreement of what constituted objective time in all the others, because they didn't have a watch, but he couldn't fool himself. He became object referred. He got attached to the mistake of the intellect. So time is an artifact of sensory perception. In reality, our universe never began and has no ending. And if you try and conceptualize that, you'll find that it's impossible. How can you conceptualize something that never began? You say maybe there was a beginning, and then immediately the dilemma is, what's there before the beginning? And if you say there's an ending, then the dilemma is, what's there after the ending? If you say there are outer edges in space, then the dilemma is, what's there after the outermost edge? So, you know, locality of location of space and time is literally comes about through a conceptual framework which says, oh, there must be a beginning, there must be an end, because that's how concepts are. But in fact, in reality, the universe is completely non-local. In other words, every point is every other point, and every bit of time is every other time. It's the quality of our attention that determines what we are experiencing. Let me explain this, even in space, since you brought up this. Every point in the universe, if the universe is unbounded, without limitations, then every point in the universe is, in fact, the center of the universe, because from every point in the universe, there's infinity extends in all directions. And if every point is every other point in reality, then the appearance of different locations is illusory. Similarly, every moment is the center point of the eternal past and the future. So every point is every other moment, and every moment is also every other point. Local space and local time are frozen points of attention, artifacts of sensory experience. We exist in an eternal awareness where everything and everywhere and nowhere are all at the same time simultaneously. And therefore, time is nothing other than a sensory experience, and we are not the experience. We are the timeless factor in every experience. This may sound very abstract, but it's the reality. It's absolutely the reality. If you want to know the reality, it's not in the conceptual frameworks of rational, verbally elite, linguistically structured thought. It's out there beyond thought in the transcendent field of all possibilities.
So once again, we're back with this term, the mistake of the intellect.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we've been brought up with such a sensory interpretation that, in fact, it's become part of the hypnosis of our social conditioning. And it's difficult to escape from it because it's so strong. We have to ultimately change collective consciousness if we want to really change the experience of mortality.
You use the term in the book Maya. Could you give a little bit of an explanation?
Maya simply means that which it isn't. I mean, you know, that which is illusory. We see this world made up of physical matter, and that's an illusion, because essentially the basic raw material of the universe is that it's not material. The essential stuff of the universe is that it's non-stuff. Not only is it non-stuff, non-matter, it's thinking non-stuff, non-matter, which gives rise to the appearance of material reality. But look at matter, and you end up with atoms, and atoms become particles whirling at dizzying speeds around huge empty spaces, and go beyond the subatomic particles, and suddenly matter has evanesced, disappeared into a cloud. There's nothingness there. And 99.99999% of the physical universe is made up of empty space, of nothing. And the 0.0001% of it, which appears as matter, this Maya, it's also nothing. It's empty space. The question is, what is the nature of this empty space? Is it merely a void, or is it the womb of creation? And today, science and spirituality merge together and tell us that this emptiness is not a void, but literally the womb of creation, that nature goes to the same place to create a galaxy or a rainforest or a human body as it goes to create a thought, because a thought is a quantum fluctuation of energy and information, like any other quantum fluctuation, that gives rise to subatomic particles that manifest as atoms that congeal as physical matter.
You begin to bring up, you bring up Bhagavad Gita. Why Bhagavad Gita?
Well, Bhagavad Gita is one of the oldest scriptures, and in one of the chapters in the Bhagavad Gita is chapter 13, I believe, verse 2, where Arjuna asks Krishna, tell me the secret of immortality. And Krishna says, know yourself as the field and as the knower of the field. Bhagavad Gita, although it's an ancient scripture, it's not, in the traditional sense, it's not really a handed down word of God. It's the cognition of reality by a seer, by a rishi. Cognition as opposed to perception. When we perceive, we see what the senses allow us to see, and the senses, bits of sensory experience, never give us a true picture of wholeness. But when we go beyond the senses and cognize the whole on the level of intuition, then we really see reality. And to see reality is to become a seer. And Krishna, in this case, is the seer who is telling his student Arjuna the nature of reality as a result of his own experiences. And these experiences give us an insight into the quantum nature of physical reality as literally a field of all possibilities that then manifests the space-time events. And the Bhagavad Gita is one of those timeless scriptures that even today stands the scrutiny of science and its insights.
Now, you mentioned before, we were talking about the I-ness and the am-ness. Do we have to move our state of consciousness, change it somehow in order to have these experiences?
Yeah, I mean, when you're in a limited state of consciousness, then you'll have a limited view of reality. And the Veda describes the seven states of consciousness. Deep sleep, which has its own reality of extreme dullness. Dreams, where there's little more wakefulness because you're now aware of some things happening in your dream state. Then wakefulness, or waking state of consciousness, which is waking up from the dream. When you're in the dream, then you're very convinced of its reality. Nobody can tell you that it's not true. It's only when you wake up, you say, aha, that was the dream. So too, when you wake up from waking state into transcendental consciousness, you can look back and say, aha, that was the waking state of consciousness. And its reality was basically an expression of that state of consciousness. And beyond transcendental consciousness, there is cosmic consciousness, which is the coexistence of transcendental consciousness with waking, dreaming, and sleeping. And then there's God consciousness, or what we call refined cosmic consciousness, where we experience the transcendent even in the objects of our perception. And finally, there's unity consciousness, in which there is just one unified wholeness. And you recognize that of the entire world, you are the creator. You intuitively align yourself with what is life at its roots. And what's life at its roots? It's creation. And you're it. So each state of consciousness is basically a state of knowledge which gives you insight into a deeper realm of reality.
All right. Now, I remember hearing once that reality was different in different states of consciousness.
Right.
You talked about the reality map before. I can see, for example, I seem to feel that you're implying the reality map is going to change too.
Oh, absolutely. The reality map changes. And including you realize that everything is ultimately self-created. If I'm dreaming, my dream time is conceived in my consciousness, processed in my brain. But so is my waking time. And it's done exactly the same way. But I call that real, and I don't call the dream real. Because, there's just a little bit more awareness in waking state of consciousness. As my awareness expands more and more, I realize that, of this entire world, I am the subtle cause. And when I realize that, then I'm free.
All right, now you've talked about this state of transcendental consciousness. Are you saying, for example, that a person needs to meditate or something in order to experience
this? Meditation is the easiest way. I mean, there are many ways. If you read the ancient literature of Shiva Sutras, which is one of the oldest texts in this area, there are 112 methods to transcend. Transcendental meditation uses the method of sound, a mantra, which I use. It's the easiest and most effortless. Shiva described some beautiful methods, and they're not so easy, but once in a while we've all stumbled upon those. For example, he says, when vividly aware through some particular sense, keep in that awareness. Another time he says, when on a seat or a bed, let yourself become weightless beyond mind. And then again, in another place, he says, see as if for the first time a beauteous person or an ordinary object, which we don't do. We don't see the world through fresh eyes. We see through the camouflage of our own preconceived notions and ideas and memories. In another place, he says, at the edge of a deep well, look steadily into its depths until the wondrousness. Once again, some other place, he says, simply by looking at the blue sky, beyond clouds, the eternity. In other words, slip into that gap, into that doorway, that is just that little bit of silence between your thoughts, and suddenly you are beyond your memories and interpretations. Because when we allow our memories, our past interpretations, to camouflage our present experiences, we lose touch with reality. We are no longer alive. We are no longer sensitive to the presence of our spirit, our awareness, our eternal being that animates every moment of our existence.
You, in quantum healing, you certainly explained very, very detailed to us how our bodies were, once again, another mistake of the intellect, in that they were very much like the river and that it was constantly changing. What's next? I mean, you've gone from creating health and return of the Rishi and quantum healing and perfect health to unconditional life, which is quite and I'll use the word quantum leap. What can we look forward to next?
Well, I'm working on a book now called Fabrics of Immortality, which is the conversations with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And it's a book about immortality. And then after that, I'm going to start working on a book called How the Universe Thinks. Because I want to show that thought is not a human activity, linguistically structured in the human brain. But in fact, this whole universe is teeming with impulses of intelligence. This whole universe is a thinking process, and when we align our thinking with the thinking of the universe, then we'll really know who we truly are.
So you're I guess saying that thinking, which we as human beings have through the mistake of the intellect have told ourselves is very special to us, is actually not.
No, in fact, we are beyond thought and we create those thoughts, but we shouldn't be misled by the lack of substance of these thoughts, of these concepts, of these notions and ideas. Ideas, notions, concepts have no material substance, but they indeed are the stuff that wars are made of. They can be the harbingers of death, the agents of disease and destruction. They have the strength to ruin our planet and cripple it, but they also have the strength to heal our planet and make it renew and create heaven on earth.
In the last chapter of your book, you say what it means to be whole. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, what it means to be whole, to bring back the memory of wholeness, is to go beyond the superficial memories to the most primordial memory of our identity, which the Veda says is Aham Brahmasmi. That means I am the universe. I'm not a physical human entity that has an occasional spiritual experience. I'm a spiritual being that has an occasional human experience. That is the memory of wholeness. When I have that memory and I'm experientially grounded in it, then I have become totally free and lost all fear, lost all anxiety, lost all hostility, lost all fear of mortality. Then I can truly experience love. And love is then no longer just a mere emotion for me. It's the experiential knowledge of my unity consciousness.
And you use the term unity consciousness, meaning consciousness of itself and just wholeness.
Absolutely.
Let's move into the realm of powers. People are very interested in the cities. That's SIDHI, I believe. What are the cities?
See, these are the abilities to go into that transformational vortex between the local mind and the cosmic mind, and then tap into the cosmic computer using the brain as your keyboard. And when you do that, then nature organizes every event in order to fulfill the intention or the desire that you have. Because your desires become the desires of nature. So siddhis traditionally are known as powers. But it's not the kind of power that people usually seek, which means the ability to control people, to control events, because there's no longer any need for that. It's really a different kind of power. It's ultimately the power of love. The traditional clash is between love and power in each one of us. The self-image is always clamoring for power, but the self, the true self, is only seeking compassion and love. And when we have that unconditionally, then we have true power, because that true power is self-power. It's not agency power. Agency power is something that you have because of a certain agency, whether it's your title or your status or your bank account or the fact that you're the head of a corporation. It lasts only as long as you have the agency. It is the power that comes from the false self, which is constantly calculating. The true self doesn't calculate. It feels, and that brings out the real power. It breaks the spell of mortality into the experience of immortality, into the knowledge of Aham Brahmasmi, which is I am the universe. Then you find your true power, and you're spontaneous. You reveal your beauty, your love, and your trust, because you're yourself. You're alive. When you carefully, calculatedly, guardedly choose your life's experiences in anticipation of other people's responses, then it's the beginning of suffocation, confinement, and death. On the other hand, this is getting in the direction of immortality.
Now, what is the purpose of, well, for example, we've heard certain cities, I mean, there's one we, of course, we hear about becoming invisible or levitating. Is that to...
Subjective experiences, Bruce, which mean a lot, because what happens is that you get the experiential knowledge that in fact consciousness is the field of all possibilities, that the absolute is the source of all creation. It's not the experience that counts, it's the fact that you discover the timeless factor in every experience, and that timeless factor in every experience is pure consciousness. You realize then that we are pure consciousness experiencing a material world through the lens of perception. Just as pure light filters through a prism and becomes diverse colors, so does pure awareness project itself through the prism of perception as the forms and phenomena of this world. It's not perception that gives rise to awareness, but awareness that projects itself in different modes of perception. And it is the same awareness that projects itself through different lenses of perception. The purpose, the real purpose of the siddhis, of these powers, is to give us confidence in ourselves as the maker of reality. And when you really come face to face with that self, you discover that the witness is also the one who's doing the witnessing.
So I think I understand that the purpose of this whole thing, is, I guess, is maybe twofold, in that first of all, if you feel yourself levitating, that of course is going to change your reality map very fast. And I guess the other one is to experience the idea that if you can break a known law, then you must be co-creating somehow.
Yeah, these so-called natural laws are merely our cosmic habits. Just like we have personal habits, we have cosmic habits. The real purpose, though, is to realize of these cities, is to realize that you are the maker of reality, that the material universe is just a small fragment, a little stepchild of a vast, ineffable, rich, abstract, life-giving force that exists everywhere simultaneously and gives rise to space-time events that we call matter.
It seems like over and over again we come face-to-face with this term, the mistake of the intellect.
Right, absolutely. this is the thing we need to escape because it gives rise to suffering. It gives rise to suffering because the self is lost for the self-image. It's our fear-based education which has taught us to hide behind this self-image, this social persona, this protective veneer, this image, this mask. It's all self-created through the mistake of the intellect. But one's inner self of me is different, even though it's built up of images from the past and all the fears and hopes and wishes and dreams and loves and disappointments that one calls mine. That does in fact give me a sense of my inner me, but if you strip all these images away, something of me is still left, and that's the decision maker, the screen, the silent witness, the eternal spirit.
Any last words?
Well, thanks for having me. I think we've addressed some very abstract concepts, and people may take a little while to digest it, but I think once you truly grasp the nature of reality, life isn't the same anymore. It's a lot more fun. Last thing I want to say is this is that's the whole idea, to have more fun. This is a recreational universe meant for those who want to enjoy God's great passions, beauty, love, and having fun. That's why dolphins dance on the seas, that's why children play, and that's why birds sing, and we should be doing the same thing.
And I want to take this opportunity to thank all of you for tuning in Timeless Voyager Radio. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.
Oh.